Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
One day John, the brother of James, was going up to the temple. A Pharisee by the name of Irenaeus came up to him and challenged him, asking, "Where is the teacher you used to follow?" John replied, "He has gone back to the place from which he came." And the Pharisee said, "That Nazarene misled you, told you lies, closed your hearts, and turned you away from your ancestral traditions. When I heard these things, I, John, turned away from the temple and went off to a deserted mountainous place. I was very unhappy, saying to myself, 'How was the Savior designated? Why did his father send him into the world? Who is his father? What kind of realm will we go to?' For although he told us, 'This realm is modeled on the imperishable realm,' he did not teach us about the latter. All of a sudden, while I was contemplating these things, behold, heavens opened and the whole of creation shone with a light from above, and the world quaked. I was afraid, yet behold, a little child appeared before me in the light. I continued looking at him as he became an old man, and then he changed again, becoming like a young man. I didn't understand what I was seeing. But the one likeness had several forms in the light, and these likenesses appeared each through the other, and the vision had three forms. He said to me, 'John, why doubt? Why be afraid? Don't you know this image? Be not afraid. I am with you always. I am the Father, the Mother, the Son. I am the incorruptible purity. I have come to teach you about what is and what was and what will be, in order for you to understand the invisible world and the world that is visible and the immovable race of perfect humanity. Raise your head, understand my lessons, share them with any others who have received the Spirit, who are all from the immovable race of perfect humanity." Welcome back to Eternal Threads. I'm your host, Daniel Klein, along with my co-host, Emily Klein. That story is the prologue of the secret book of John, also known as the Apocrypha of John. I've heard many who say that the Gospel of John is a great place to start for new Christians, so I figured we would start with John for our discussion on the Gnostics and the Nag Hammadi scriptures. Today, we are going to cover the story of the early Christian groups called the Gnostics with special guest Dr. David Brackey to guide us through the tale. I'm sure you'll love this episode as much as I do, so sit back and enjoy as we explore early Christian history together on today's Eternal Threads.
I'm finding all of this content to be brightly illuminating as I look into it. The deeper and deeper I look, it's unraveling more and more that I have to learn about. I'm still trying to figure out what my head thinks about some of it. It gets complex. It's going to be a long road, but worth the trek. Got to get those steps in anyway, right? So far, I'd say my favorite to read has been the Gospel of Truth in the Nag Hammadi scriptures, more specifically the section called Do the Father's Will. That's in the Marvin Meyer translation. This was one of those scriptures that came to me at just the right time. What's most entertaining for me is watching Daniel learn about all of it. This is literally his Roman Empire.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here, which is really interesting. I mean, we're going to talk more about the Nag Hammadi scriptures, you know, a little bit later. But the interesting part is that they were dated to be back from the 3rd and 4th centuries. So even some small things, like I believe that a better Holy Trinity is the Father, the Mother, the Son. There's a lot of layers there, and there's a lot we can unpack in that. But the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, a lot of these texts have been written, rewritten, rewritten, rewritten over the past 2,000 years. So being able to see direct scripts and direct scroll, well, codices, I should say, from the 3rd and 4th century directly before those rewrites provides a whole different view.
And not just rewritten, but also translated from other languages. And there are, you know, certain languages where one has several words for something and another doesn't.
There's some differences, and that's what's so interesting. Okay, so let's break down some basics real quick before we go into, you know, this amazing interview that we have for you with David Brackey. So the interesting part is if you think about our modern American society, there's really three major influences to our society. It's Roman, Greek, and Jewish. Okay, you know, you look at our government. You know, in our military, very kind of Romanesque. Greek gets into our philosophy, our academia, and Jewish just because, you know, our entire idea of Christianity is really based on, you know, Old Testament, Torah, Jesus being a Jew. And when, you know, you look in the Bible, it almost creates this narrative that Jesus and, you know, the Jewish people lived in this cultural vacuum of them and the Romans. Okay. So what's interesting about the Gnostics is it really opens up this conversation a little bit. Now, speaking of timing, we had this interview for a little while, and I'm so thankful that it took us a little time to get this episode done, because I'm not sure who watches The Chosen in our audience, but a recent episode just came up, and some of the things that they put in there I think is amazing, and it's one of those, like, blink, don't think about it, and you might miss it. But there was just a scene there where, if those that watch it, there's a I forget what episode it was, just about an episode or two ago, but Yusuf is a new Pharisee, and he's being shown around. And at one point, they point out this group of Jews who are Hellenistic Jews, and they're wearing blue, and there's a whole group of them in the temple. And you just don't always think about these things. You don't think about, like, oh, like, Greek was Greece was a pretty major country, and the Greek have so many important figures of this time and a few hundred years before then. I mean, the likes of, you know, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and all these guys were just a couple hundred years before the time of Jesus. So not only did they make their historical mark, but they left a legacy of new schools of thought that were developed by their students and expounded by their students, which slowly permeated to other societies and became cultural foundations for the thoughts and ideas of spirituality overall. Going back to our recent interview with Pastor Adam, he was talking about how he likes John because of, you know, Logos. Mm-hmm. And that's Plato.
Yeah.
All that is straight Greek Plato, thinking of God as intelligence, as wisdom, you know, as sort of part of everything, you know. And it's I didn't realize that until doing some deeper study and seeing how even the Chosen put Hellenistic Jews inside of the synagogue as part of the Pharisees. I'm like, aha, like everything was so much more interconnected. And the Greeks really get pushed out of this entire conversation. And when you think about not only Gnostic is a what word?
A Greek word,
yeah. Right? But then you think about, okay, well, what were the early biblical texts written in? Like, when we found all these biblical texts before we did translations and stuff, what were some of the original texts written in?
Well, it was all written by different people. Some of it was Greek and some of it was Aramaic.
In Hebrew.
In Hebrew.
Yeah, those were the three. But what did the entirety of, for the most part, you know, of Rome speak? And that was Latin.
Right.
So Latin only came secondary.
To Greek.
To Greek, Aramaic, and Hebrew. And then English, obviously, way down the line.
Well, I think it was Greek first and then Latin and then the other languages.
Yeah, either way, but Greek.
Yeah.
But how often do we talk about Greek and Greece? And then how often do we, like, compare the ideas of the time to, once again, like Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, you know, Epicurus, all these different people who had all these really interesting ideas that helped create our country that we live in today. So it's stuff that, you know, you look, you know, back at even just some of the, you know, more basic sort of cultural impacts that other groups had on Christianity, even some simple things like, you know, the Easter bunny and the Christmas tree, which have some heavy Germanic pagan origins. But I mean, even the Christmas tree can be pushed back as far as Egypt, where they would bring palms into their home during the winter solstice to celebrate Ra and the sun's triumph over death. which a son beating death definitely has a familiar ring to it.
Right, for sure.
But by the first couple centuries of the Common Era, society was relatively stable and developed with the rule of Rome, similar to our current age. So there was a lot more time to ponder these deep truths and, you know, kind of what's happening now. We're having a lot of people that I think, you know, are quote unquote waking up.
Right.
You know, to lots of ideas because everything is so provided for and we have free time to where we can question everything. And I think there was a lot of that going on back, you know, back then during that time. So the fact that we sort of forget about how deeply impactful the philosophical ideas of the Greeks were on the whole of civilization, and we don't discuss that when discussing the Bible, you know, when he started putting in more and more Gentiles into this fold, there was a lot more thought and a lot more questions. You know, this is where we're going to get into it during the interview. But there was a lot of people who didn't understand with this new gospel coming from Jesus and him coming from God that this Old Testament and the Old Testament God doesn't always make a lot of sense. And there was a lot of questions there. And then you have Paul himself. And Paul himself, you know, told the Gentiles they don't have to follow the Torah. They don't have to. You know, it was also, you know, really specific on the fact that Jesus was Jewish, and you know, so that it's double-sided there. So don't get me wrong, but when you tell a bunch of people to follow Jesus but you don't have to follow the Torah, and then you give them all the facts and they're, you know, have a philosophical background of any type, you're going to have a lot of thought leaders of that day, which we'll discuss them individually, at least a few of them, are going to come up with their own ideas and their own schools and their own thoughts. But it is, you know, history does tell its own story. So it worked out the way it was supposed to work out. But the fact that we don't talk about a lot of that stuff, this is a great, great place to get started. And I'm sure in future episodes, we'll talk about, you know, Platonism and some of the things that came out of Greeks. So that way we can get a better, more robust understanding of our historical stories.
Yeah, this is all super hyper interesting, especially, you know, connecting all of the dots between, you know, how we think and behave amongst each other in modern times and connecting that to the origin of this school of thought and how life was back then. And yeah, there's a lot to it. And I'm so excited to keep learning more.
Yeah, now the idea of this actually just gained some traction relatively recently. So I'll cover this briefly because we're going to cover this a little bit more, and David's going to tell us more about it. But the Nag Hammadi scriptures were just discovered in 1945.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Okay, and it was by happenstance for the most part. So this really just started gaining some traction recently. The texts were lined up to a lot of old texts. Many of these texts were referred to multiple times in other texts, but the academics and everyone else just didn't even know if they existed, let alone that they were real and this is what they said and all this. So it's been a remarkable, to say the least, one of the most monumental discoveries of all time to help us better understand this spiritual story. Now, in the grand scheme of things, there's always been a somewhat of a divide between some of the ideas of a church hierarchy, social structure, and the concept of religion to that of a mystical and personal idea of spirituality. These texts not only represent a broader view that Jesus represents with his more mystical side, and it also aligns with Eastern philosophy a little bit as well, but it creates a deeper oneness between all the religions of our modern age and shows a story of a wider world of ideas at the time. Since Jesus invited the whole of the world to share one humanity, then all the variations are worth understanding, and they exist as a part of a larger divine plan that brought us here together today. And with that, it's also helps strengthen the idea that Jesus could have. That's why all those missing years between it being a kid and being 30, he could have spent time with Eastern yogis. He could have spent time with the philosophers of Greece. And by bringing some of those ideas back to, you know, the whole of Judea, it could have been, you know, disruptive and interesting. I know me and Emily were just watching a thing about the Stoics. Mm. And he told us of this great, you know, concept of when something bad happens to you. Okay. But what he utilized was an example of is what if the whole of civilization or, you know, the whole of your story, whatever the greater good is the whole body. Okay. And sometimes we're the foot. Now, if the foot could be conscious on its own, if the thought, you know, if the foot could analyze on its own and you were to step in a big puddle full of mud, how much would that foot enjoy it? You know, if it could analyze it, it'd probably be mad that it's all muddy and dirty and down in the dumps. But if that mud puddle is just a step to a greater good of where we're going to get food, to get shelter, to get whatever, and we could see the greater good that, all right, well, I have to get muddy in order to get where the whole body is going, would we be so upset? And from that type of stuff, it's just such an aha moment. I'm like, well, that's a great analogy. And this is kind of a parable, mm-hmm. which is similar to how Jesus taught. So he could have spent some time with some of these people and learned all these ways of aligning these ideas in a way that's very human, that isn't so, you know, theological and so scripture-based. So that way it's very common for everyone to understand it. And for all we know, he could have gotten some of that from the Greeks, whether it's from one of these teachers themselves or just people who were involved in these schools. Well, not with the teachers were generally, you know, Aristotle and all these people were a couple hundred years, but still those schools of thoughts maintained. So this is where he could have, you know, got some of this stuff from. So it's just good to understand it all in order to understand the larger good. So definitely a lot to unpack, but luckily we have some help. So today we are going to speak to Dr. David Brackey. I'll let him introduce himself here in just a few, who is one of the leading experts on early Christianity and the Gnostics. He also teaches on Christian monasticism, which is another big interest of mine as well. But he's going to help us build a foundational understanding of who these groups were, the main figures responsible for the development of their ideas, and will help us understand the early centuries of Christianity in a more robust way. Studying the Gnostics has definitely given me much to consider about core theology of Christianity, and it's through this process of continually seeking that has brought me at least closer to God. Now, the interesting part is I used to feel very conflicted about being a skeptic and at times a cynic, which are also two schools of thought of Greece and ancient Greek. Above all else, the skeptical inspired me, though, to find more sources for every idea and make my own conclusions. And after all, whatever we believe about anything, there is a layer of faith involved. For example, history is written by the winners, and whoever ends up losing rarely, if ever, considers themselves or their cause that they are fighting for evil. Just two sides of the same problem, and one will eventually win over the other. That's the spectrum of existence and ideas. I always like to use the reference of Star Wars when I talk about good and evil. It's being American, like most Americans, a lot of us love Star Wars and always are rooting for Luke Skywalker and the Rebels. We see the Imperials as this evil group who wants to industrialize everything and rule the world, laying waste to entire civilizations and planets, stripping their resources and focused on power. By using the direct reference to the light side, dark side, the distinction is clear as day. Who the good guys are, who the bad guys are supposed to be. However, once again, being American, if we look at American history over the past century or two, America tends to fit the description of the Imperial Empire more closely than it does the rebels. The irony may be lost on some, but I promise you, if you look out, you know, internationally, many people will understand that it's pretty funny that we love the rebels when we are, in fact, a lot of times the evil empire, or can be perceived to be the evil empire. So are we good or bad for trying to create the world at large in our image? Well, the answer is always both in different ways, but we will find out in the future, depending on really who writes the book. The analogy is similar to all history, including Christianity and the Bible, and only by seeking out all the details can we understand the fullness of Christ's message, because it's often not this or that, but both and all, because ultimately it's all part of God's creation and his history. Now, one caveat to some of these teachings that I'd like to point out that will be touched on briefly later is the idea that not every text is for every person and that there tends to be layers of spirituality. Some say that Mary Magdalene was giving special teachings that only she would understand because the male apostles were heavily influenced by society and they believed that women weren't supposed to be involved in the church. You'll even see in the Nag Hammadi scriptures, you do have like the secret book of and some of these things that were given only certain people because they could handle it at that time and others just wouldn't understand. So especially when talking about deeper spiritual ideas where ultimate truths can be found, not everyone always has the background or even the interest in contemplating and discerning deeper meanings. It's not a question of intelligence, but just what point of the spiritual journey we're on, because whether you're a person of faith or not, the mystery of the soul still includes you. And it makes me think of like all these sayings that I've heard, you know, ever since I was a kid. You know, very simple stuff you put up on posters in like school classrooms and stuff, like the golden rule, treat others how you want to be treated. And when you're 10 years old, like you sort of get it.
Well, and that idea exists on multiple different religions too. It's not exclusive to Christianity.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not saying anything about the different religions. I'm just saying that.
No, I'm just pointing out that's like a common.
When I was 10 years old, though, you told me certain things and I wouldn't be able to handle it or get it. So if you take 50 people and you give them this really deep theological, philosophical teaching, some of them will be like, holy moly, that's going to change my entire life. And other people will be thinking about how their socks are mismatched or they got to do laundry later or, you know, everyone's just on different pages all the time. So it's just, you know, it's one of those things. So it is, there's a lot. There's a lot to learn and it's going to be a lot of fun. So without further ado, let's dive into a world of early Christianity and meet some of the historical figures that shaped it. Once again, I want to thank Dr. David Brackey for sharing his knowledge with us. I'm a huge fan of his work and can't express how thrilled I was that he accepted our invitation to be on the podcast. Be ready to flex those brain muscles. This interview will not only educate, but will change your fundamental understanding of the early Christian story by including the wider world. Right after this short break.
Your clothing could preach louder than a Sunday morning sermon, all while supporting your favorite podcast? Well, now it can. Introducing Eternal Threads, a clothing line that's divinely inspired and possibly more uplifting than your morning coffee. Like many of us, I wear my heart on my sleeve, but now I also wear my faith on my chest. Ditch the corporate logos and represent what you believe. Get ready to turn heads and maybe even hearts with our vibrant collections at eternalthreads.com.
Discover elegance with Sterling Adornments, where genuine gemstones and sterling silver craft stories of beauty. Each piece, a testament to God's gifts, is meticulously handcrafted for your moments and milestones. Embrace the unique, the pure, the divine. Start your journey at sterlingadornmentsus.etsy.com and find a jewel that speaks to you. That's sterlingadornmentsus.etsy.com, where every piece illuminates your inner glow.
Welcome back. Let's get started with our interview with Professor Dr. David Brackey and have him tell us a little about himself.
I teach in the history department at Ohio State University, and before that, I was at Indiana University in Bloomington for 19 years in the Department of Religious Studies. And at Ohio State, my job is to teach the history of Christianity, and I specialize in the ancient period, but as part of my job, I teach everything, essentially, the entire history of Christianity. So. But most of my writing and research is all antiquity-focused.
Now, I'm going to hype David up just a little bit. I first learned of David Brackey from the Great Courses Signature Collection, which I found through Amazon. You can also see it on Audible and a few other places. But he has one that goes, it's like they're at least 24 episodes a piece, but one goes over understanding the New Testament, another one, the Apocryphal Jesus, and a whole one on Gnosticism from Nag Hammadi to the Gospel of Judas. He has written many books, one called The Gnostics, Myth, Ritual, and the Diversity in Early Christianity, The Gospel of Judas, a new translation with introduction and commentary, Demons and Making of the Monk, Spiritual Combat in Early Christianity. And recently, he just wrote the foreword from a book by another writer, Keith Giles, called The Quantum Sayings of Jesus, which is about the Gospel of Thomas. So very, very good stuff. And this guy has been my favorite teacher of the Gnostics. And I've watched his Great Courses signature collections multiple times. It has been a cornerstone to my education and understanding of these groups. So I really can't thank him enough. But without me hyping him too much, let's have him tell us a little bit about who the Gnostics are to get a baseline.
We don't really know about the origins of the Gnostics, right? So the Gnostics take their name from the Greek word gnosis, which means knowledge, but in a very...
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Personal and direct way, not knowledge you just get from reading a book. You really know the thing. And there was an ancient Greek adjective from gnosis, gnostikos, and they apparently were the Gnostikoi, the knowing ones, or whatever. So, we first hear about them in the texts of their opponents, who wrote in the mid to late second century, right? The 200s, I mean the 100s. Boy, so anyway, so the mid to late second century, the 100s, is when we first hear about them. And for centuries, of course, we could only know about them through their enemies' reports about them. They were obviously not friendly, sympathetic reports, until the discovery in the mid-20th century of a set of manuscripts at Nag Hammadi in Egypt, which preserved some Gnostic works, right? So scholars just have no idea. We fight and discuss where the Gnostics could have come from. But the important thing is their main idea. And that's the main idea is that the God who created this world and whom you meet in Genesis, doing various things, creating the world, causing a flood, and so on, is not, in fact, the highest supreme God from whom Jesus came. Rather, he is a kind of lower divine being who has gone bad and is now actually hostile to human beings. So their essential insight, if you want to put it that, is that we have hitherto, before Jesus, really not known, we have not had the gnosis or knowledge that the God who created this world is not the ultimate God, and that we do not, therefore, we human beings don't really belong in this universe, this world, whatever you want to call it. Instead, we have our origin in a purely spiritual realm over which the true God exists. And humans have been living in ignorance of this fact for the most part, but Jesus has come and revealed this, and this is this insight, this gnosis or knowledge that Gnostics claimed to have had.
Definitely some different ideas there, and a great way to get us started. So let's hear about what the Gnostics believed in the way of a creation myth compared to what we know from Genesis.
So if you think about what I just said about what their views are, then the key problems become, how did this God who created this world originate and make this world? And then who is Jesus incarnating? Who, you know, who is present in Jesus? And you asked about the first question. And the fact is that we have basically two Gnostic explanations for this. The most well-known one, because Irenaeus reported it, and it appears in a very important Gnostic work called The Secret Book, according to John, or Apocryphon, right? Is that God, the ultimate God, called the Invisible Spirit, kind of, because he wants to be known and to know himself and so on, expands into a series of kind of lower versions of himself, kind of multiplies, called eons. The last of which that he generates is called wisdom, in Greek, Sophia. And she is coded as a feminine person. Sophia is a feminine word in Greek, and she is kind of presented as a feminine character. According to this version, Sophia tries to have a thought or an idea on her own without the cooperation of her male counterpart. So all these eons are kind of set in male-female kind of pairs. And because she does that, without her male counterpart involved and without the consent of the invisible spirit, the ultimate source of everything, she produces a bad thought, a thought gone wrong, an error, if you want to call it that. And that error or thought becomes kind of incarnate, instantialized, crystallized into this being that the Gnostics usually or often call Yaldabaoth. The etymology of which people discuss, or sometimes Sakla, and sometimes, you know, there are other kind of terms for him. Yaldabaoth is the most favorite one. But Yaldabaoth, because he is divine in origin, has been able to take from his mother, wisdom, divine power, creativity, if you want to put it this way, the spiritual mojo that makes true divinity happen. And when he does that, he is able to create. And what he does is create this universe from matter based on his vague knowledge of what the true spiritual world is like. And so this world is kind of a copy, not a great one, but it is a copy of the spiritual world made by this really deficient divinity. But then, you know, what happens is that the wisdom and everyone is like, oh my gosh, you know, this is terrible. And they trick this Yaldabaoth into blowing or releasing his divine mojo, his spiritual power, into humanity. And so now you have this situation where this god, this Yaldabaoth, thinks he's the best god, because he's kind of a little bit dumb, and he's hostile to human beings because we really come from the arena that's higher than he. And he is therefore always attempting to stop us from, he wants to control us, blah, blah, blah. So that's theory one, which kind of relies on a notion of kind of a divine error, if you want to put it that way, like God is a brain who thinks and there's a glitch, so to speak.
We can already see that coming from a non-Jewish background, the Gnostics were just trying to make sense of the story of Jesus and the stories from the Torah from a viewpoint that related to their own culture. One of the conversations that got me excited to discuss early was that many Gnostic Christians were exactly that, Christian, and they were followers of Christ and believers of the gospel. So trying to touch on all this stuff and make sense of it, they definitely had a lot to work through, and they had a lot of questions that were fair, judging from Jesus's gospel and the stories of the Torah.
Is what these Gnostics share with many of their contemporaries in the second century is a vision of God that is essentially Platonic and comes from Plato, which is that true divinity, the ultimate God, must be purely intellectual and spiritual and not directly involved with this messy material world. And so God, although there's only one, must have a kind of multiplicity to him or it in order for things to happen. And that is indeed the kind of generating idea behind not only the Gnostic vision, because God unfolds into all these eons, but indeed the original, the Trinity develops obviously over centuries, but the original way of thinking about Jesus, the divine being that comes into Jesus, the Son of God, is kind of also thought of in this way. So yeah, it goes back, you know, they share this idea that there's one God, but that one God has to be multiple in some way.
Times back then were just as layered and complicated as they are now. Just like different denominations are strewn across our communities, it's more about the personal relationship than specific rites and rituals. The amazing part is the impact it can have 2,000 years later, with most of us never even knowing the original story.
Bound up with this issue of God and Jesus and the God of the Old Testament, or the Jewish scriptures, is bound up with a lot of other questions. Are we, I'm going to speak now as a Christian of the second century who is not ethnically Jewish. Okay, how do we relate to that tradition? And, you know, this had been a problem since the earliest days of Christianity, and Paul had to, you know, was deeply involved in disputes with other Christian leaders and apostles about this, because he argued, Paul did, that new believers in Jesus who were Gentiles, not Jews, did not need to follow the law of the Bible, right? So they don't have to keep kosher, don't have to circumcise their boys, and so forth and so on. But that raises then a host of issues. Then what is this text for if we don't have to actually do, you know? So you can see this is all a big issue that has to be kind of figured out by these non-Jewish believers in Jesus, because somehow they're related to that tradition, but they've moved away from it. And the Gnostics take a pretty negative line, right? The God of the Old Testament is actually, you know, satanic, mean. And they didn't obviously just make this up. I mean, they saw things in the God of Genesis, especially causing the flood, raining fire on Sodom and Gomorrah, and so on, that they found not appropriate behaviors for a true God, right? But of course, other Christians are just going to completely push back and say Jesus was very clear that he is a Jew and he believes in the Jewish tradition and so forth. And so that God, and Paul insisted on this as well, the God of the Old Testament is the father of Jesus, right? So it's a, you know, so you have in the second century and into the third a kind of spectrum from kind of the Gnostics on one end with kind of Marcion a bit, who argue that the Jesus just doesn't come from the Old Testament God at all, to on the other side, there's really no difference between Jesus and God the Father in the Old Testament. You see this in a text like Acts of John, where Jesus and the Father are basically the same. The Son and the Father, there's no difference between them at all. They're just different manifestations of the one God, right? Of course, what's going to happen is that Christians are going to try to settle on a kind of mediating thing. They are one, but yet separate at the same time. So that's the issue. But you have a whole spectrum of ways of trying to deal with this problem.
The best part about all these stories is that they really make you think outside the box about our existence, reality, and especially morality. Whether all true or false, the conversations I've had on these topics have been profound. This is why when I heard the term Gnostic and its meaning, I couldn't think of a better term for my...
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
relationship to Christianity.
Right. I mean, it's in the period we're talking about, the second and the first, second, and into the third century, it's not like you have different denominations, because they're not organized enough to say, "Hi, we're the Lutherans, and we're the Presbyterians, and we're the Roman Catholics." And so and there's none of that. Instead, it's kind of lots of people now use for the second century Christianity kind of like a laboratory, where everyone is trying out new ideas, and they haven't quite settled on what it is. And we do see some organized groups. I mean, groups that are like, "Here we are, and this is what we believe about Jesus." But for the most part, it's kind of a mishmash, and they're all trying to like figure out what it is they actually believe. Yeah. And even the Gnostics, because I told you there's actually a second theory the Gnostics have for where this God comes from that doesn't involve wisdom. And you find this in the Gospel of Judas, which we didn't even know about until this century, right? 2006. Well, we knew it existed, but we didn't have it. And that's much simpler. God does expand into these eons. Then one of the eons calls into being kind of angels to run this cosmos. Someone has to do this. So they like say, "Let's appoint some angels." And then these angels, led by this Yaldabaoth figure, rebel and decide we're going to be in charge and just do our own thing. So he's still negative. But his negativity comes from his rebellious thing. And he actually has the name, well, the lead god has the name Nabro, which is, they say, means apostate. See, he went away. So they, you know, you can tell they're trying to figure this out as well. And they're not always completely on the same page, even within them, among themselves, the Gnostics. Yeah. The Gnostics definitely do not believe that our true selves are material, right? So the bodies that we have, this is, you know, the realm of Yaldabaoth, who is indeed for them Satan. They don't have a second Satan figure. I mean, that's, this guy plays the whole role of, you know, that. So yeah, that's, they believe we belong somewhere else. But I should say, when you say I'm a, you know, I think of myself as a Gnostic, so forth, we should say that Christians did not in the ancient world cede that term to the Gnostics. That is, that what later people that later Christians would identify as Orthodox or Proto-Orthodox or whatever also adopted that term for, you know, someone who has advanced to the point that they have kind of very strong knowledge of God that's kind of mystical, it's beyond. Great example is Clement of Alexandria. He lived in the late 100s, early 200s. He said the true Christian is the true Gnostic. Obviously, he's using true Gnostic to say, not like those Gnostics, right? Maybe the true Gnostic. And then later on in the 4th century, big-time monk named Evagrius from Pontus, who was a big monk in Egypt, he also said the most advanced monk he called the Gnostic monk. So Gnostic remains a, you know, it's a term that ancient Christians were not willing to, like, let these people have. So lots of them clung to it as a badge of honor and something to which Christians who even don't share the Gnostics' ideas, to which they should cling. They should aspire to be that way.
Not only different creation theories, but I've always had concerns about the rules and regulations that come with some versions of faith, in that the teachings themselves can get lost in the pageantry and the traditions. Even the cross itself can be considered idolatry. However, Dr. Brackey talks a little about the Gospel of Thomas, which I very much enjoy because it is a collection of sayings by Jesus, which focuses solely on his teachings rather than the narratives seen in the biblical Gospels.
I mean, Gospel of Thomas is a great example because it definitely presents the goal of the Christian is indeed to have gnosis of both God and oneself, you know, and so it has this idea, but correct. It is not invested in an elaborate myth. I mean, its basic idea is there is a God. That God is highly spiritual. We have come into this world as souls that are akin to that God, and we need to recognize our true selves, and Jesus reveals that to us. He's mainly a revealer figure. They, you know, the Gospel of Thomas, you could surround it, you know, if you want to tell a story, well, how did the souls get here? I suppose you could make one up, but the Gospel of Thomas doesn't really give you one, right? It just is, the central insight is, and it's pretty much Plato, right? That we belong to the realm of intellect and spirit, and this material realm is not, in the end, our true home, and our goal is to return to that. And but they don't have an elaborate myth to explain all that. They're just, you know, this is our situation. And, you know, but they're not, you know, and people have often, you know, today practically no scholars continue to call the Gospel of Thomas Gnostic. Originally it was, you know, people labeled it as such, precisely because it doesn't have this myth. Just doesn't have it, you know. I mean, it just doesn't. Yeah, they don't. Well, you know, what to call a Gnostic and what not is something we historians love to argue about, right? And it's not always so. Anyway, but you see, back in the day, scholars would just lump everything together that wasn't like mainstream Christianity as we think about it as Gnostic, right? Everybody is a Gnostic who thinks, but. We're trying now to be a little bit more differentiated in our understanding of these people and groups, and not, because once you call the Gospel of Thomas Gnostic, you start importing into it ideas that you know from a Gnostic work like the Apocryphon or Secret Book according to John. You start going, oh, well, then it must believe this, that, and the other thing, when it doesn't say anything about those things. I mean, possibly the author believed those things, but, you know, maybe not. I mean, you know, so it's, we're trying to be a little bit less lumping together everything and a little bit better at seeing the different currents of Christian thought in all of its diversity.
I love this point. How often do we lump everyone all the time, Christian or not, Democrat, Republican? Emily and I consider ourselves modern Christian Gnostics, but we definitely care more about love and righteousness and God than we care about Yaldabaoth, the Demiurge, or where it all came from. But let's talk about some of the main names of that era and who helped define some of the early Christian groups. I remember hearing about Marcion early, but Dr. Brakty gives us some greater clarity. He crafted one of the first collections of the Gospels before the official act, heavily influenced by Paul, especially Paul's teaching that the Gentiles did not have to follow the Torah to follow Jesus. Marcion has a story that's worth telling.
Yeah, again, Marcion, we don't call him much a Gnostic anymore because he differs with the Gnostics. So Marcion differed from the Gnostics, and then he did not have that myth we just said. But what he ends up saying is that Jesus, like the Gnostics, he says Jesus does not come from the God of the Old Testament. The God of the Old Testament is the God of the Jews. He is a righteous God. I mean, don't kill, don't commit adultery. These are all good things, right? But he's also highly retributive. He punishes people. He doesn't, like, forgive them. He doesn't, you know, and so if we try to follow his law, we kind of find ourselves in a spiral of, you know, well, I'm trying to do this, and but, you know, I can't, and then he blah, blah, blah. So Jesus comes from a different God, a hitherto unknown God, who is loving and gracious and forgiving. We don't have any writings directly from Marcion. We have little snippets, and we have blah, blah, blah. And so it's unclear how these two different gods originated. Okay, so we just know that for Marcion, the God of the Old Testament is, and Marcion is a righteous God who's God of the Jews and who will still send the Messiah to the Jews, because it's not Jesus. Jesus is the representative of this higher loving God. is coming to have mercy on us, and so forth. And yes, Marcion claimed, now he could not have known Paul, because Marcion lived, you know, in the 130s, 140s, right? And that's when we have traces of his activity. And Paul died in the 60s. But he claimed to be totally inspired by Paul and to have recovered Paul's true message, which is precisely what I just told you. So he is known to have assembled a collection of Paul's letters and to have coupled them with a gospel about Jesus. So the people who criticize Marcion and live, from which we have most of our information about this double kind of New Testament looking book, right, lived decades after Marcion. And they claimed that Marcion actually had the Gospel of Luke and he edited it so that he would remove any passages from the Gospel of Luke in which Jesus might have suggested that he was actually from the God of Israel. Right. Because this is what Marcion says is not true. And Marcion, according to this, according to these people, took these things out because they must be corruptions or interpolations in the text, you know, things that people put in later or something like that. So too with Paul's epistles. Many scholars today do not believe this. We believe that Marcion had access to a gospel that is similar to Luke, but not the same as Luke, and that both the Luke we know and Marcion's gospel are like potentially edited versions of this now lost gospel. But you're right. The big thing he did was say, when we get together for church on Sunday, we will not be reading from the Old Testament, because that has nothing to do with us. All about Jewish people. They can read that. We do not. But we will read from this two-volume thing that I have put together, which has a gospel and a collection of the letters of Paul. It looks like he had 10 letters of Paul, lacking 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus from the New Testament. So he didn't have all 13.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
In the New Testament, say, attributed to Paul, but only 10 of them. So anyway, that's the story of Marcion. And he was a, by profession, he was a shipmaster. And he came from Asia Minor moved to Rome in the 130s, 140s, and was very enthusiastic about his ideas. And, you know, was like, look, this new thing I have. This is the true message of Jesus and Paul and so on. But apparently he and the other Christians kind of didn't get along. So he was like, I'm not going to have anything to do with you. And he started forming his own network of congregations, which persisted until, you know, into the 300s. We still have complaints about what are called Marcionite churches.
Marcion represents an interesting idea. What if we only study the New Testament? What kind of church would that look like? Being a newer Christian, I'm not laid in with specific beliefs, so being open and learning about them all has been very interesting.
Well, this, you know, this is the thing, is that most of the people at this time would have been more like you, or even have less preparation. I mean, these are, we have to remember that probably at this time, when Marcion's doing his thing in the 130s, 140s, and other Christians are pushing back and saying, no. And of course, remember, they're already Gnostics. And the Gnostics are, no, Marcion, you don't have it right either, right? We have to imagine, I mean, scholars debate this, is that at this 130s, 140s, the vast majority of believers in Jesus are non-Jews. They are not, you know, there are probably still converts from Judaism, but the vast majority are not. And so all of this would have been new to many of them. I mean, they probably knew things about Judaism. They knew they had a Bible and, you know, and that they had, that they were followed a certain legal institutions, and they had this temple in Jerusalem that had been destroyed in the year 70 and so on. But, you know, this kind of intense knowledge we're kind of talking about now, no, they would have had to. So, you know, I don't think it's like many, like if you're an early Christian in Rome, you probably weren't going shopping around, right? And going, do I like the Gnostic group or the Marcion group? You know, whoever you, or the, you know, what we would call proto-Orthodox group, what do I like most? You probably just fell in with one of these groups. It's when they become, and remember, very few Christians, right? Not many. So, so it's only when they become more numerous, Christians that is, and more organized, that they really start bumping up against each other, right? And, you know, and discovering, oh, you don't even read the Old Testament at church? What are you talking about? You know, so...
Now, to give a little extra context is, compared to Christianity today, all the stories in the Bible we know really well. So not only were many of these groups coming up and trying to figure out these ideas, but it was also very social and just based on the location of where you were as well.
When ultimate truth is at stake, I mean, this is the important thing to understand, right? And people's salvation, people tend to take these things rather seriously. And Christians, you know, even when you're a really small group, like they were at this time, sometimes the differences become even, are even more noticeable, right? You know, so you're, yeah. But yeah, but Marcion is an amazing and interesting figure. And there are scholars who, you know, what they work on is trying to reconstruct, for example, the gospel that he had. Because we, again, only know it through quotations. Like, you know, someone will say, well, Marcion's gospel reads this, which we know is completely wrong, you know, or whatever. So then they, you know, have to piece that all together and see what they can discover.
If only we can have another Nag Hammadi to find Marcion's lost manuscripts.
Well, we do. Yeah, I mean, you know, it would be helpful, but unlikely, right? So yeah, and of course, even those texts we discovered at Nag Hammadi—not me personally, but humans—they are in Coptic, not in the original Greek, and many of them, you know, they were almost certainly copied in the mid to late 4th century, 300s, even though some of the texts we know are from, like, the 100s. And so the question becomes, what are we really reading the, you know, how close are we when, you know, the Gospel of Thomas, great example, right? We have, like, three fragments in Greek.
Was some saying the Gospel of Thomas could have been written as early as 60 AD, predating all other biblical Gospels? I wanted to ask Dr. Brackey when he thinks the Gospel of Thomas was written.
Well, this is a great question, and I'm kind of an early second century person on this, right? So for a while, everyone thought, oh, it's probably really early.
But predating the Gospel of Mark early? How early?
I think that's still possible. We just, it's hard to tell. You can see at places that the Gospel of Thomas that we have in Coptic, which is the only complete version, there are places where the author or the scribe or whoever copied it, translated it, whatever, is aware of the wording of the four Gospels in the New Testament. So then the question becomes, did that wording enter the Thomas transmission of the text when it was written so that the author actually knew these other Gospels and was like drawing on them? Or did it come later on in the history of the text so that people eventually were like, oh, look at this. He's got this wrong because I've read in Matthew, Jesus said, blah, blah, blah. You know, so they assume they're correcting it, right, properly. So it's, you know, that too is a big world of very technical scholarship. And so I'm a little bit, you know, I'm uncertain. But, you know, Could be late first century, could be early second century. Can't be much later than that, because the earliest Greek fragments we have seem to be from around 200. So, and then the question is, do you find references or, you know, citations, quotations, whatever, of the Gospel of Thomas in other literature? This is the other way you date things, right? And so then you start looking for those, and when do you start seeing them? And, you know, someone like Origen, a great Christian scholar who lived in the 3rd century, died in, you know, around 253, 254. He quotes the Gospel of Thomas several times. So he definitely knew it as a Greek text by then.
I love that not only does David talk about the origin dates, but the most important thing we should always keep in mind is that how many hands it's touched in this epic game of telephone throughout history. This is a good time to introduce Valentinus, who lived in the beginning of the 2nd century, and his impact on the Christian story and how information about Christ was already spreading.
So Valentinus, whose followers become known as the Valentinians, right? Valentinus, you see, a lot depends on what texts you're willing to attribute to him. Dating him precisely is a little bit difficult, but we know he seems to appear also around the 130s and then disappears probably after like 160. We don't know what happens to him. And he's in Rome. Rome was a fascinating place for Christians. And he, you know, he is clearly was an inspiring and brilliant preacher and thinker. And people fight about this, but he seems to have known the Gnostic myth that we just talked about with Sophia and Yolde Both and all that business. And yeah, there seem to be hints in his work that he knows the Gospel of Thomas. Scholars sometimes argue about this. It seems, I am persuaded that he does. And so he knows, and he knows Paul, and he knows the Gospel of John at least, and he, you know, and all this, and he's obviously read his Plato, and he just kind of is one of the first kind of individuals we can identify who's really putting stuff together and creating his own unique theological voice, right? That we can identify and say, wow, he's a thinker, you know, that someone, you know, a thinker like we think of, you know, St. Augustine and Luther and Aquinas as being a great thinker who takes together, who's read a lot of stuff and really presents a vision of what Christianity is. All this from very little fragments of him. So, yeah. But yes, and he, you know, he has, you know, a bunch of students who admired him and taught in his tradition, so to speak, just like we talk about Augustinians and Thomistic theologians and stuff like that after Thomas Aquinas.
Not only was Christ's message making its way through Rome, we also asked him about another major hub for Gnostics in Alexandria, Egypt.
Right. So Alexandria is harder to put a finger on because we don't have the first person, the first text or source that we can say, ah, yes, definitely from Alexandria, and gives us a report of what's going on there, is this Clement that I've mentioned, who's towards the end of the 2nd century. While for Rome, we have earlier texts, okay? And, you know, and people talking about, you know, this guy named Justin Martyr lives in the middle of the 100s, and he's like, I'm in Rome, and I know I hate Marcion and wrote a whole book against him. You know, so he's right there and saying, you know, this is what's going on. So the question becomes, you know, we know all these people end up in Rome, like Valentinus, but did these ideas of the Gnostics and Secret Book of John, did they originate in Rome? And people are thinking it's much more likely it was Alexandria. And one of the reasons that is because these people have also, some of these folks have read this very important Jewish middle Platonist or Platonist thinker named Philo, who was a contemporary of both Paul and Jesus. So he lives in the early first century, dies just before the middle of the first century. And he already had engaged in a lot of this, you know, Genesis, what do we make of this? And had been reading, because when we read the Apocryphon of John, of the Gnostics, that person has clearly not just read Genesis, but he's also read Plato's version of creation, which is in a treatise by Plato called Timaeus. And Philo has also read the Timaeus, and he's like combining Genesis and the Timaeus and trying to understand them, how they're both true and going together. And that's what we kind of see in some of these Gnostic works and the like. So people tended to see Alexandria as a more likely place where a lot of these things originated. And Clement does tell us, Clement of Alexandria that I've mentioned, about people who were earlier in the Alexandrian context that he has read and knows about. And they, too, we can kind of start to talk about. But yes, Alexandria is a very, also, yeah, very learned, cosmopolitan city, probably had the best library in the ancient world, which is another reason why, you know, a lot of this stuff probably was happening there. And yes, it's kind of more happenstance that we know more precisely what was going on in Rome, because of the survival of these texts. But also, you know, Rome was, you know, it was the center of the empire. There was a lot more money there probably than in Alexandria, which brought a lot of people there. So, yeah. But Alexandria, very, very important place. Yes.
While all of this was going on, Orthodox groups were also forming, which would go on to build the church. Our original understanding of Gnostic ideas before the discovery of the texts at Nag Hammadi were from critics of these groups. Let's take a look at them and what caused some of the variations of belief.
Obviously, what starts to happen is that Christians fight about these ideas, right? And, you know, the first person we know of who really says these people are heretics is a guy named Justin Martyr, who lived in Rome in the middle of the second century. And now, originally, heretic comes from a Greek word hieresis, which basically means choice or, you know, option or free will or whatever. And had come to being, hieresis had come to have a kind of more intellectual or social sense of school of thought. So, for example, if you're in the world of medicine, you needed to choose among whether you're going to be a Galenic doctor or a Hippocratic doctor or a methodical, you know, you had to choose your school of medicine, right? And so Justin started to argue, this is Justin Martyr, that we Christians of who believe like me, we have the truth, capital T, right? Straight from Jesus, right? And these other groups like the Valentinians and Marcion are actually just schools of thought, options that people have chosen. Their leaders are therefore heretics, members of a hieresis, right? Not true Christians, but heretics. And why does this happen? Why do these people like Marcion and the Gnostics and Valentinus and his followers exist? Because demons make it happen. Demons have inspired, just as demons inspired the Romans to crucify Jesus, and demons inspired the ancient Athenians to cause Socrates to commit suicide, so too the demons cause these people to appear, and so heretics are bad. And so they believe in demons, so there you go. And so he wrote a book that he refers to called Against All the Heresies That Have Ever Existed. We do not have that book. But it seems that Irenaeus, who lived a few decades after, he's a few decades younger than Justin, he wrote a book around 180 called Detection and Refutation of Gnosis, Falsely So-Called, Knowledge, False Knowledge, which we now know is Against the Heresies. And he apparently took Justin's work and kind of plagiarized from it and used its ideas. And yeah, so he wrote a book that you know, his true enemies, Irenaeus's, are the Valentinians, because they are active in his area. He lives in Lyon in Gaul, modern day France, and he knows Valentinians, and people are like going to see Valentinian teachers because they're really interesting. So he has to write a book that shows they're actually completely wrong, the Valentinians, and all their ideas come from other heretics like the Gnostics and Marcion. And he has, you know, he gives a whole list. So anyway, so yes, so he is, and he is some sort of ordained church official. Sometimes he's called a bishop, sometimes he's called a presbyter or priest. So he is an institutional figure of that kind. And he starts a whole genre of literature, which Justin really started, but we don't have his anymore, called heresiology, in which you write a book that lists and explains and refutes the views of heretics. And Hippolytus is the reputed author, though now there's a lot of arguments about this, of the next big work. Well, there's Tertullian also wrote one, but another big work in Greek, because Irenaeus wrote in Greek, even though he lived in the Western Empire, called The Refutation of All Heresies. And that goes even back to like heresies of the Greeks and so forth, even before Christianity existed. So yeah, this becomes a major genre of literature. And, you know, because it always has to be updated, because there's always new heresies, right? I mean, you know, so, you know, it just keeps going because new heresies are identified. And yes, and until the 20th century, pretty much, the only way we knew about all these people, like the Gnostics, the Valentinians, and Marcion, and so on, was through the reports of these heresiologists. Though, it turns out that, you know, when we can check Irenaeus now, which we can often do, he's, you know, not too far off. You know, he obviously knew either an early version of the Apocryphon or Secret Book of John or one of the sources that that author used, because they match up what he reports. And, you know, the other things he says that don't match up with the Nag Hammadi work are now much more plausible now that we have Nag. You know, sometimes you read Irenaeus and you think, oh, he's really just making this up. This just can't be true. Well, now we have Nag Hammadi, and, you know, the things he said, some of them are true, and the things he says that aren't in Nag Hammadi are very much like what's in the Nag Hammadi text. So it's not, we no longer have this extremely skeptical attitude about the myths that Irenaeus reports. But of course, he and all other heresiologists also say that the people they're criticizing are immoral and unethical as well. So he's often reporting, and of course, you know, they seduce women and, you know, so forth and so on. And that's the part that we kind of go, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, that's the mudslinging that you just don't think is true. So, but yes, none of these guys, I mean, Irenaeus did want to be helpful. The book was written so that people who don't know as much as he does about these people will be able to recognize them when they see them. So he wants to be somewhat accurate, right? But he also is not indeed writing a source book for 21st century historians. No.
It's very interesting to see how different the methods can be by having a different master during your teachings. Even the apostles themselves struggled with preferences of one person's teaching over the other. Once you're one step away from Jesus himself, the game of telephone distorts through the lens of the speaker, so variations happen immediately. Definitely a lot of politics to win the favor of the people. And once again, the importance of the discovery at Nag Hammadi cannot be understated. There are so many references to these ancient texts that were in doubt for centuries. To have so many be confirmed with the finding of these texts has filled in so many gaps in Christian ideas and history. Dr. Bracke gives us an example.
Well, the biggest thing is indeed a section of his work reports the Gnostics believe in this invisible spirit, and then this invisible spirit generates this being called the Barbalo. And this is all, and he's reporting this, and then there are these four luminaries, and he gives us all their names and so forth. and we were, you know, before then, scholars would have been like, what, Barbalo, what are you talking about? It's all in the Apocryphon of John. It's there. So, so it's, you know, true is what it is. So, yes. And, you know, people often notice that, and sometimes say, well, you know, Irenaeus may not be totally right because it's way clearer in Irenaeus than it is in these non-commodity texts. And I'm like, well, yeah, that tends to happen. Like, you know, when my students read the Apocryphon of John, they're like, you know, oh. And then they come to class and I explain it to them and they're like, wow, now it's clear. Well, that's what's going on, you know. So anyway, yeah. So he, you know, what people are not persuaded by with Irenaeus is that one way he denigrated these heretics, as he calls them, is by arguing that they exist in a kind of genealogical descent that all traces their error to one person, a guy named Simon Magus. Simon Magus is a character in the 8th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, where he shows up and is impressed by all the miracles the apostles are doing and asks if he can, like, buy the whole... What's that power you have? Can I give you money and get some of that? So, from which we get the term simony, which is the buying and selling of church offices, because he offers money to get the Holy Spirit. Well, anyway, he then is identified as the first heretic, because he's a believer in Jesus, but he's bad, and he appears in the Acts of the Apostles. And so what Irenaeus, and presumably Justin before him, argued is that Simon had students, and those students went off and taught other people, and this is how these heresies happen. Because there's a demonic succession of teachers and students who then come up with all their new ideas and so forth and so on. And we do not believe any of this. I mean, well, some of it is probably true, but not, you know, because you sometimes look at him and say, he says so-and-so taught so-and-so, and you can go, yes, that seems to check out. But a lot of it is just one big fantasy. As a demonic counterpart to the true succession of bishops who all go back to the apostles. So he creates this kind of two, there's the divine, wonderful succession that of bishops and priests that all go back to, so like in Rome, Peter was the first bishop, right? And all, you know, the rest come from him. So they all have the truth, obviously, but the heretics all go back to Simon Magus, and they all have dumb ideas, and they keep changing their ideas and so forth and so on. So that, you know, and he does tend to say things like, you know, they, you know, are seducing women and, you know, giving them potions, they get loopy and then you can have sex with them and stuff. You know, he, so, you know, those things, you just kind of go, you know, whatever. But, yeah. And they continue to make up stories like this. But, you know, like Hippolytus, Refutation of All Heresies, he'll, like, quote long sections from heretical books. Very helpful. You know, so...
We see that there were already a lot of cooks in the kitchen during these early decades, many of which never knew Jesus personally. So by learning about them all, keeping an open mind and having open discussions, this is a great way to grow as a Christian.
Yeah. I mean, look at, you know, here's another Irenaeus example, right? He says, oh, these Gnostics, they're so crazy, they even wrote a Gospel of Judas. And, you know, where Judas is the one who knows everything and, you know, and he has a role in bringing the cosmos to an end. And of course, people were reading that going, come on, who would have a Gospel of Judas Iscariot, right? That's just nuts. Maybe he means Gospel of Judas Thomas or something like that, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, then guess what? It shows up. And Irenaeus was correct. And what he said, it said, it says. So, you know, there you go. It's just, you know.
I know Judas is a tough character, but just like Jesus himself, without him and the role he was destined to play, we wouldn't have the story of Christ's sacrifice.
No, he's a fascinating figure. I mean, in the Gospel of John, Jesus says to Judas, go and do what you must do. You know, I mean, Jesus basically tells him, you have to do this, so go do it, right? He doesn't, he's not like, oh, don't do this. You know, he's, you know, you have to go and do this. So, yeah. I mean, there are some great modern imaginations of Judas that, to be honest, are way better than the Gospel of Judas. So, yeah, go read, you know, great book. is Jose Saramago's The Gospel According to Jesus Christ. Go read that one. That's really good. Yes, he won the, you know, Nobel Prize for Literature, so he's good. So anyway, there are all these, like, you know, and so, yeah, great Jesus movies where Judas is presented. So anyway, Judas, fascinating figure. Yes, yeah.
Now, before we switch over and talk a little bit about the Nag Hammadi scriptures, let's cover one more important figure during the later Gnostic period during the late 2nd and early 3rd centuries, whose name is Origen, who seemed to want to bridge the gap between different schools of thought.
Origen is an interesting figure because, like the Valentinians, the Gnostics, and so on, he is a believer that the ultimate goal is a kind of gnosis or mystical knowledge of God. But Origen was completely saw himself as part of what we'd call the mainstream church. So he worked within that context, but he also believed that, yes, like Irenaeus suggested, the apostles have transmitted to us the things we must believe, but they didn't transmit everything to us. And so there's room for speculation. So, for example, he argued, we believe, based on what the apostles taught and we find in the New Testament that and the Old Testament, that God created this world, so it had a beginning in time, and it will come to an end, as Revelation, for example, suggests. But, Origen says, no one has told us what happened before this world was created, or precisely what will happen after this world ends. So we can only speculate on this, but he went on to argue, the Bible, Old and New Testament, has within it all the answers to the questions that we have. We just have to search for them. But we may never find them. And it's possible to disagree and to find different things and so forth and the like. So he is indeed what you might call a seeker, an intellectual seeker after higher truths, but within a kind of limit, which is that there are some things you can't say. Like, you can't say, like the Gnostics did, that the God of the Old Testament is satanic. He's the father of Jesus. You know, he's the creator and all that stuff. That's just what it is. So you must believe that. You can't, there are these basic truths that everyone must believe, and you're going to be perfectly fine if all you ever do for your whole life is believe those basic truths and live nicely and be a good Christian. But he says there are some of us who are what he called lovers of wisdom. And, you know, so yeah, why didn't the apostles explain everything? Because they wanted us to have something to do. To have something to think about. And, you know, so he, you know, yeah, so that's his thing. Yes, yeah, so he didn't always get along with the bishops who were running the church. He was essentially told to leave Alexandria, where he originally was, and he moved to Caesarea in Palestine, where he found much better reception. So, you know, he's an interesting figure and has often been inspirational to Christians of a more academic and intellectually adventurous spirit than others. So yes, that is him. And he tried to meet the Gnostics and the Valentinians on their own terms, so to speak, and to provide a kind of alternative view of the things that they, you know, they said we're not our bodies, right, and so forth. So he tried to come up with a response to those kinds of views that would also be intellectually satisfying and not just, you know, you have to believe this because I said so kind of stuff. He wrote a book called On First Principles, and that's his basic, like, you know, and this is where he explains everything I just said to you is the first book, first chapter, first principles is, you know, yes, we have to believe these things that the apostles taught. There's one God, Jesus is, and so forth. But he then goes on to say, we have all this other stuff we don't really know, and let's think about it. And this did get him into trouble, and it got him into trouble later, and after he was long dead, because, you know, he would float ideas that later Christians said, no, we don't believe that. And so then he was condemned for... Yeah, so there you go.
Origen presents a type of person who aligns more closely with what we believe and how we feel about knowledge.
He acquired, as a teacher and preacher, an intellectual, international reputation. And he would go on lecture tours outside Alexandria, and other bishops and priests would love him and so forth. And so part of the story is that his bishop at the time found him a little too big for his britches, right? He was like, you know, hey, I'm the chief Christian in this town, not you, right? It's like, you know, if you run the university, it's one of your professors become way too popular for you. You don't like it, blah, blah, blah. Origen's biggest commitment in his theology is to the idea of free will. That is, that God will not coerce any of us into loving him and being good. He leads us to that. And what that means for Origen, there are these horrible people who do terrible things and die as bad people. Origen's like, God still loves them. And Origen was convinced that after this world, there are new worlds. And that people, it may take multiple worlds, but God will bring all sinful human beings back to himself. Never force it. Okay. Now, if you take this as your basic theological principle, this suggests that, for example, demons and even Satan himself might someday be redeemed in the long run. And Origen was accused of actually teaching that, although it's very hard to find that statement in his works, not all of which survive and blah, 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 blah. So anyway, but, you know, so that's an example he's essentially what people would call a universalist, right? Everyone will be saved. Now, does that include demons and Satan, who are, in Origen's view, also like us, fallen intellects that once loved God but now have fallen away from loving God? That's the question. And, you know, he was accused of saying, yes, it does include them. Other interpreters of Origen said, no, he was only talking about humans, you know, and stuff. So, you know, there you go. And, yes.
Origen's story also shows how politics can play a role in history, and we appreciate how he wanted to challenge the typical thought process of the time to include everyone.
Right. In Origen's view, Valentinians were teaching that there are three kinds of humans in the world. Spiritual ones, they're Valentinians, and they are going to be saved. Animate or psychic ones, that comes from the word for soul, so you're at the level of soul, and those are ordinary Christians who might be saved, might not, they just haven't. If you're a Valentinian and you look out into the world, you see basically three types of people. People who don't believe in Jesus, you call those people material people, because they are just... Then there are all these Christians who don't have the advanced insight that Valentinian Christians do, ordinary Christians, and they're the ones at the level of soul. And then there are Valentinians who are at the level of spirit. Origen interpreted this to mean, as did Irenaeus and other opponents of the Valentinians, as a kind of deterministic thing. You're born into one of these categories, and that's your fate. Nothing you can do about it. Okay. You know, Origen was very, you know, he wanted to say, no, you don't belong to one of these three categories. Everybody can turn to God and love him and be virtuous. Everybody can. And God will help you do that. But you participate in that. And and so he did want to hold out the possibility that people who, you know, get only, you know, like this far, after this lifetime, there may be an opportunity to go a little bit farther. He doesn't believe in reincarnation. This is very important to say, right? So it's not like you're born into another lifetime here in this cosmos. No, he's talking about future worlds. So that this world will come to an end, and there's something else next, obviously, and he believes that that something else will contain within it the possibility for people who, say, only got to this level in this world to go up.
This story I definitely didn't know before this discussion, so similar to reincarnation, but a much broader idea, which adds to the collection of theories of our existence.
But we don't even know that the next world will involve, like, physical bodies. We don't know any of this, you see. But Basilides, according to a little report on him by Clement of Alexandria, actually did believe in reincarnation. That is, so why is it that, like, for example, a baby can be born who's clearly done nothing wrong, and this baby has terrible suffering? Get some terrible disease or whatever. And he explained this as, indeed, that this baby could have had a previous life where he or she was really bad. And so, because God is always just, you see, God is always just, he would not make an innocent being suffer. So you know, you have to kind of explain that. So you ask Origen why this happens. He does not say we had a earlier life in this world that we're now being punished for. He believes our souls, our true selves, were all originally in a previously completely spiritual existence before this world was created, and that we all fell away from God to different degrees. Satan fell the furthest, angels fell the least far, and we are somewhere in between. So God has placed, according to Origen, every soul, has caused every soul to be born in this world at the precise date, location, and circumstances that will be best for you to make progress back towards God. So it's all pedagogical. It is all, you know, like, you know, you may look and say, you know, oh, poor so-and-so, you know, his life's been so hard and so forth. Origen would say that this is the best life for this person's spiritual condition. And God has planned it that way to lead this person back to God. But again, not coercive.
Whatever is true exactly, even in our suffering, there is a greater purpose. Having a view that is larger than this one single life really helps us make sense out of some of the acute suffering that some lives experience while others do not. There is a greater and deeper reason for it all, and learning how to be grateful for the duality of life, although not easy, gives meaning to the entire process. Next, let's talk a little about the Nag Hammadi scriptures themselves and the history of them.
Right, so Nag Hammadi is a place in Egypt, and in what we call Upper Egypt, so southern Egypt, right? Not near Cairo, but lower down, or higher up on the river, so to speak. And across the river from Nag Hammadi, in 1945, we believe, someone discovered jars that contained a total of 13 ancient books. These books are written in Coptic, the last stage of the Egyptian language, and are dated sometime, scholars always are going to argue about this, the earliest they could have been made is around 350, but they could have been made any time from then to, say, around 450.
A small detail I liked was the fact that they were in book form rather than scrolls, which early Christians utilized. Although used by others, Christians were early adopters of the book form, which we use today.
Yes, they are not scrolls, right? In the ancient world, right? Yes, well, Christians were they were not the originators or the people who made codices, as they're called, right? Books that were used to, right? Bound like this. They're not the ones, Christians didn't invent it, nor are they responsible for it, but they were early adopters, so to speak, as we would say, right? But they also, you know, we know the Christian because they have, like, Christian symbols and, you know, crosses and stuff on them. So, and, you know, all these texts, most of them, not all of them, have Jesus in them. So anyway, so there they are. They're in Coptic. Some of them are very fragmentary. Some are very intact. and the like, and they contain texts that that match what Irenaeus and others tell us the Gnostics and the Valentinians taught. And then they include texts that don't match what the Gnostics and the Valentinians taught. So, and include, like, for example, a brief section of Plato's Republic. So they're a diverse group of texts. We believe all of them were originally written in Greek and translated into Coptic. But it now means that we can read texts that come from the Gnostics, the Valentinians, and others for ourselves. Yes, in translation, but in ancient translation. So, for example, there are four copies of this secret book or Apocryphon of John among these 13 books. Four different versions of them. And so, you know, it's great. And among them was the Gospel of Thomas, which, again, we knew existed because people referred to it. Origen did. He said, there's a Gospel of Thomas. Hippolytus said, oh, here's a quote from the Gospel of Thomas. And we were able... There are also three Greek fragments of the Gospel of Thomas, but people didn't know what it was until the full Gospel of Thomas was discovered. And then they were like, oh my gosh, these Greek fragments we've known about for 100 years are also the Gospel of Thomas. So it's really revolutionized our knowledge of the diversity of early Christianity.
The Nag Hammadi scriptures are robust, so we will cover more of it in future episodes. The Gospel of Thomas has been relatively the most popular so far, so we wanted to see if David had any sayings he enjoyed more than others.
Well, I don't know that I have a favorite, although the original one, let the one who's seeking not stop seeking until they find is, of course, I think, which is right at the very first, is, of course, I think what every historian and person interested in religious seeking should take to heart. And do most of them, you know, I have my favorites that don't make any sense to me. Like there's the one where the lion eats the man and man becomes a lion, or the man eats the lion. And it's like, who knows what that means? I don't. So, you know, there you go. Yes. So there's all sorts of these things. Yes. And of course, the most famous one has to be the last one where Peter says, send Mary away because, you know, females are not worthy of life. And Jesus says, you know, I will make Mary male so that like you males, she may enter the kingdom or whatever it is. And that's a fun one to talk about at great length. So yes, it's presenting itself as something that has to be figured out. Right? It's not obvious. I mean, that's the whole point. That's the beginning of it, is these are the secret sayings, or perhaps the word might also mean hidden or obscure, right? Sayings of Jesus, and you have to seek them and find them and so forth. But surely the most striking one is not even the last one. I think the most striking one is, what is it, 42 maybe? I don't know. Be passersby. That's the whole saying. Be passersby. As I like to say to students when I'm explaining that, you know, it's asking you to have an attitude towards this world like you might have to a rest area on the interstate. You know, you're not there you're just there for a brief period of time on your journey. It is not where you need to set you shouldn't be invested in this place. You are a passerby. You are moving through. So, you know, as much as I love the Gospel of Thomas and find it really interesting, it doesn't exactly encourage, for example, social action and working for social justice and so on. It's a, you know, we don't really belong here kind of thing. So anyway, it's fun.
Besides the Gospel of Thomas, David then talked about one of his other favorite texts from Nag Hammadi.
Gospel Truth was really exciting. And some scholars are like wild and crazy like me, and we think that Valentinus himself actually wrote the Gospel of Truth, although his name is not on it. And Irenaeus doesn't actually say that. So Anyway, so that one is also totally exciting. And, you know, and it is definitely about, you know, us all being kind of on a journey to find God, not just out there in some space that's not us, but within ourselves as well. And it, you know, it's an amazing text. So that's, Nagamati has been absolutely transformational for our understanding of ancient Christianity.
Now, it wasn't just these early Gnostic groups that helped create and spread mystical and personal ideas about Jesus and Christianity. Monks following monastic ideas throughout the centuries kept these ideas going in their own way, which we will absolutely invite Dr. Bracky back to hopefully talk about in the future. Already having a desire to learn more about this group of Christians as well, it does seem like they are connected to the ideas of the Gnostics.
You know, it's not surprising that a lot of historians like me who work on Gnosticism also work on monasticism. You know, that's my other life, right? I work a lot on monks and, you know, write books on monks and go visit monasteries and all that kind of thing. And, you know, one could argue that from a kind of big picture point of view, that what Christianity ends up doing in the like 4th and 5th centuries when monasticism is really getting going is find a place for the kind of spirituality you see in texts like the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Truth, where it's really an individual kind of quest and reading of books and having an experience, to find a place for that within the wider church in monasticism. And, you know, you... And yes, I mean, sometimes monasticism is very rule-based, but not always. And sometimes that rule-based is precisely to enable that individual journey in a communal context. So, yeah, so Christianity develops and takes these things in.
We know this has been a whirlwind of information, so feel free to listen to this episode multiple times to absorb it all. Dr. Bracky has been extremely helpful on my journey with the Great Courses Signature Collection episodes he has taught on. I do enjoy reading, but being of the television generation, I'm able to absorb a lot of information more quickly with video content, so I can't express enough of my appreciation for those series. I would say that our attempt to squeeze 24 episodes worth of content into 2 hours has been a heroic task, but Dr. Bracky did an amazing job of breaking down the first couple centuries of Christianity in an understandable way.
Well, that was fun. Now, once again, we do consider ourselves modern Gnostic Christians, so we hope this episode helped you understand the vast landscape of Christian ideas and how seeking knowledge has been a path to God for centuries. Is there a gap between religion and science? Only if that's what you believe. But it's just as easy to believe that they are one and the same, and that the seeker, the skeptic, and the cynic are just as holy as the believer full of faith. In this age of science, technology, and enlightenment, it often feels like we can't have both a logical and spiritual side, but just like God himself, the answer is all because everything is just another manifestation of the divine creator. So until next episode, praise Jesus and God bless.